Accession number 2008, rail 7.
Okay, so I have our reel 7.
Right, we moved to a little village south of Eindhoven, to a place called Waring, and we all went into a kind of civvy billets there, although, you know, we had our own cookhouse and everything. And I was billeted with a driver on a Dutch family who the wife was a German. A Dutchman married a German, and her mother lived just over the border, and somewhere around about. And of course, she got a family of two young sons, and we spent the best part of the winter there. And then we went down. They sent set up a school down in Belgium on the river. I don't know, Major Walker was in charge of it anyway. But we were going to cross the Rhine, you see. And before they'd done that, they took all the troops and the big bods down there and got all the equipment for crossing the Rhine, what they was going to use, like powered rafts on horses and ducks and everything. And they worked out a program for the infantry and the tanks and all that as they were going to get across. You see, and they done that all the winter.
So were you just billeted on the civilians over that
and
period?
We went down there and done this Rhine thing in some Belgian pit town. I don't know where it was near. I'm bad at
it. Doesn't matter.
Anyway, yeah. They set up this school and we done that. Of course, we done flamethrower with any regiment what hadn't seen the flamethrowers, and the Yanks and all that. They come up and demonstrate and show them how to walk through it and all that, so they wouldn't be afraid of it. Of course, they're a fearsome thing. You know, fire, I reckon, it's a terrible thing. I know, I've been burnt by, not banned, but I know what the pain is, you know what I mean? And fire strikes fear into people, I think.
What was the Allied troops' reaction to flamethrowers? You've mentioned what the Germans were like, but what were the Allied troops like?
Well, some of them took out the line because they wouldn't go through it. You see, they'd never seen it before. Punishment, they take them out the line and they have to do training, and then it's demonstrated. And it's quite... These flamethrowers, they could throw about 120 yards flame, and it's awesome, really. As I say, when I was first introduced it to me, it was awesome. But once they showed that, once it's on the ground, we had to walk through it. We all had to walk through it. As soon as that's down, the signal was that the boat stopped firing, we walked through it.
Are there any effects of walking through it?
No, there weren't no effects then. The only thing was that it used to get on your boots. You see, if you're standing up and it hit you, that'd spray all over you. But once it's down on the ground, you could walk through it. That'd stick to your boots, but you used to rub it off in the dirt, yeah. Well, that's when they had the... Rhine Crossing School, anyway, I don't know. I know the place, I could take you there tomorrow, perhaps.
I'm sure that'll be on the record, but you were demonstrating this to Allied troops, were you?
We set up the school for the Rhine Crossing, and in that time they were demonstrating to the Yanks and anybody what hadn't been introduced to it, the flame prize. That was part of the job. Then we come back up Holland for the Rhine Crossing. We was on transporters, if I remember. Got up as far as Nijmegen. We was going at night time. You see, every movement was done at night with all these. We had a long line of transporters, I forget what they were, whites. I don't know, they're probably whites. And I know we was on the back of this transport and we was going along, and of course there was a horrific bombardment going on all the while, right, and the aircraft, anti-aircraft fire was going up, and this plane was going round and round. I was looking up there, and all of a sudden this plane dropped a flare. And I said to the old gunner, I'm going to get inside the turret. He said, no, that'll be all right. Christ, and then about a half a second later, he was in on top of me. I'd been hit. He did Jerry dropped a bomb right in front of the transporter. I blew the engine out of the transporter. Well, I say blew it out. They disabled it, you know, blew it out. The driver and co-driver were all right. And Dave Gennard, our driver, he was outside in the front. He was all right. I was all right in the turret, but George, who stood behind the turret, you wouldn't have thought he'd got hit in the thigh. So I said, well, we had to get off the transport and had all that out of the way, and we went along, we had to follow on to the Rice Bowl Forest. I put a dressing on old George's thigh, and it didn't look too bad, you know, but like, yeah. But by the time we got into the lager at Rice Bowl Forest, he was in agony. So they carted him off to see if he was with the Canadians. They carted him off for the Canadian first aid post and back. Never saw more of him there and more. He came back to us after the war. He got his slit like a happy sorry.
What about half a foot long, yeah?
Huh?
Half a foot long?
Yeah, well, I think every bit 9 inches, and where that went in, that was only that, but that must have been in a very delicate place, I should say, in the thigh. That must have been near something or the other. They opened him up all that way and didn't take. Well, they don't in the army. They don't take. They're no microsurgeons. If you saw my appendix scar. Yeah.
So when you moved at night, would you move without lights? In convoy?
Oh, yeah, mostly, yes. Especially up the Rhine Crossing, we were moving up in moonlight, you know. We went up into the Rice Bowl Forest, and we harboured up in there for a week, I should think.
Was the fighting still going on in the Rice Bowl Forest, or had it finished?
No. They got the Germans the other side of the Rhine then. They got the Germans the other side of the Rhine. We was this side now.
So this is about March 1945?
It would be, I should think, yeah. And we holed up in there. Of course, they sent a bloke up as a replacement for George in old Bill Rose, that was. He come from Suffolk. So I had another kind of East Anglian with me. So he was quite a character, this bloke. Big, gawky kind of broad-speaking Suffolk. He was a nice bloke, really. He was George's replacement.
And what kind of rations?
When we was in the Rice Bowl, we went up into the trees, you know, the Jerry observation post, what they'd had when they had this side. Well, we went out and looked over the other side, and the height of some of these trees they went up used to make me giddy going up there. You know, right up, they got observation platforms up there, and they could look all back for miles. I suppose that was artillery observation.
You were telling me off the record you had special rations in the Rice Bowl Forest.
Oh yeah, we shot a deer in the Rice Bowl Forest, and we had a bloke who was a slaughterman there. He skinned it and cut it up, and I think we carried that for about in the water bucket. We had a canvas walk. I think we carried that in there for nearly 2 weeks eating it. We boiled it up, and that was it used to taste nice. If you was hungry, you know. I mean, if if the cook has come up and that was a dark night, and they say, oh, we'll have some fresh rations today, they'd bring a cook's lorry up, you know, with these containers in these hay boxes and that. And they'd empty, you know, they'd open the containers up and you'd queue up with your Dixie and they'd slop stuff in the dark, you know. You couldn't, you didn't not know what it's like, what it was, but you did enjoy it. If you was hungry, you'd enjoy anything, I mean.
Was there many signs of the recent fighting while you were in the Reich Wall Forest?
Oh, the guns were going all the while. You see, while we was in the Reich Wall, there's 2 or 3 days we pulled up in there, they had these smoke screens going, these smoke generators all along the Reich. They were going all the while. And well, we used to lay in the beds because that was quite warm for the time of the year, if I remember. And we'd look up through the trees and we'd see hundreds of hack shells going up and the old Jerry planes flying around. You used to wonder why they could fly around there for about 3/4 an hour and nobody hit them and they go off. You know, you'd think that's a miracle. And you could see the plane where it was because that was flying all around. And we used to look up at the trees and see it. Yeah. And we got across it. Of course, we went across the Reese with the Canadians. And we had to take the high ground through north of Emmerich on the border, so we had to take the high ground there. Well, we was getting shelled when we got across the Rhine, and that took us 3 days to get through Emmerich. You never seen such a place in all your life.
How did you cross the Rhine?
A bridge cross. They wouldn't allow crocodiles to cross on rafts or anything. Wouldn't risk them. That was a bit more luck, although I didn't have a trailer or anything. We went over to London Bridge. I think it was the London Bridge. They called it London Bridge at Reese. Anyway, we got across and we harboured up in this farmyard. And we was doing sorties daily with the half squadron to go in action, the half squadron to be back. And we was in this farmyard, and I thought I'd go up and see if we could get a chicken for dinner. And there was a hell of a row in this chicken house. And I said, hey mate, would you chuck us one of them chickens out? And no sooner said than done, and a couple of chickens come out there with the next run. And a Canadian officer come out there, he said, I wasn't after the chickens. He said, I wanted a few eggs. So I got this chicken and I was plucking it and there was a slit trench here. I don't know whether, I suppose the Jerry's must have had it on it. I don't think we dug it. I was sitting there because Jerry was on the high ground with just lobbing over these shells, you know, occasionally. I sat there in the slit trench packing the old chicken. We balled it up in the Dixie. Yes, it was quite some fun. When we got through Emmerich, we took the high ground. Well, before that happened, I mean, we were 3 days, I said we were 3 days getting through Emmerich. Every morning, about 8 o'clock or 8:30, a long stream of medium bombers had come over. This is a nice sight to see, you know. They come over, all in formation, over top of this high ground, and let the bombs drop 3 mornings running, they done that. And when we got up there, all the positions for the guns had all been dug, but there wasn't nothing there. Jerry just took them off and gone.
What was the state of Emmerich as you were in the...
Oh, that was absolute... that took us 3 days to get through it, because you had a bulldoze way through it. Oh, did. Once you got into Germany, Cleve, Gock, that side, the Rhine, and once you got into Germany, anything that was standing, you put a shell through.
Was that a general procedure that you'd do?
Well, it's just frustration, I suppose. The blokes like, I mean, the custom posts, all their big swastikas on them, and right bang through the middle of them would be a shell hole, and they'd put that through just to, just to bust it up. They never took any notice of property once they got into Germany. I mean, I used to feel sorry for the old Belgians and hard Dutch, but I don't know why it was. They didn't worry about the Germans, and I think they caused enough trouble.
Did you have any contact with German civilians at that stage?
No, they mostly were in ground in cellars and at the civilians. All we saw was prisoners, and most of them were poor specimens. It was getting bad, you know. They were either Poles or Hungarian. Well, I'll tell you the truth, the Poles were capturing Poles who were fighting for the Germans, taking them back, putting them in uniform, feeding them and sending them back up and fighting for their own. Oh, yes, I've seen Polish blokes kissing the German prisoner. Oh, what the hell's that? Then when we found out they were Poles fighting for the Germans, who had been captured by Poles fighting with the British, and the chap said who I was talking to, he said, yes, he'll be back there in the khaki uniform tomorrow, he said. They'll turn him round.
So you took the high ground above Emmerich? And the
Germans, and then we went from there to Apeldoorn, back into Holland. See, the Canadians back at Arnhem, Holland, you know, where the Arnhem fighting was. And then we went from there to Zutphen.
Were you in action at any of these stages?
What?
Were you in action at any of these places?
Oh, yeah, we was in action all the while, you know, but not a big action. You see, mostly we was assault troops, right, really. That was our position. Like, if Jerry dug in a certain place, we flamed across canals and things like that. But they were set-piece attacks, but they were only minor actions, really.
Would you be called on by corps or division to do it at
all? Oh, yes. Well, you see, if they get hold up, if they used to have maps, of course we used to have them, the second in command and squadron leader used to have what they called defence overprints. We used to have maps, and then we used to have a photographic kind of shinograph thing used to put over the map, and on it was all the details of the mines and strong points in the thing. So they used to call them defence overprint. You see what? Well, we used to have them. I mean, if they were going to lay on a big attack, but local things. Once we crossed the Rhine, more or less things started rolling. I mean, we was moving miles and miles in a day, and Jerry was only just kind of holding up for half an hour, or most of the bridges were blown. They used to, you'd be held up while they built a bridge across, and then we went right the way up to Groningen, nearly up on the side of the sea where the Germans could get across from Holland. That way, we got up there with the Canadians.
Had you been transferred to the Canadians by that stage?
Oh, we was always with the Canadian Army, yeah, over there. Although the British, when we was down in Antwerp, Vietnam, we had some British blokes, you know, with us. I mean, it all depends who was available, I suppose. In the reserves, I mean, that was expanding all the while, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, the front was expanding while we was doing a clearing Antwerp. I mean, the front was expanding. They got all the east side up to the Americans and all that up there. And then we was going right up Holland, weren't we? And all the while, the front was expanded, more and more troops had got to be brought in, I suppose, and eventually they fed in troops, you know, what had been in reserve or something, or even with the Canadians they swapped over. But we always stayed with the Canadians until we got the Groningen.
What was your opinion of the Canadians?
Oh, they were all right. Essex Scottish? French Canadian. I'd never seen anybody treat prisoners like they did. But mind you, they had a hard time. Or they run them out of action on a motorbike, you know. If they didn't run fast enough, they'd soon lift them up the back of the air hole with a butter or a rifle. I mean, when you've seen things, what they say, I suppose that makes you do that. But I thought that was a bit... after all the blokes, some of them were on stretchers, carrying stretchers and that. No. That was a bit naughty, really, I suppose, but yeah, what can you do? They'd probably seen the mates killed and that.
Was that the French Canadians?
That was in Amerik. Amerik. Yeah, we lost a tank there. Flying probably, yeah.
How did that happen?
To tell you the truth, the story I heard, as I said, I'd never go to look at anything might have been done like that, but I heard this from an officer who was with the echelon where I had to go and clear up the mess, take the bodies and that. That a German SP gun opened up on the Churchill and the pannier door was closed, and that hit the pannier door and knocked it open, and another shell, the next shell went right through it and blew the whole thing up. No, how true it was, but that's what they reckoned it was anyway.
So after Amerik, it was a very fast moving...
Well, yeah, we couldn't keep up in Churchill. What was about 18 mile an hour, if you was lucky. And the bogies used to, you see, the old bogies on them were little old things, weren't they? And you used to see them part and run up the road, and then you got to stop, and you got sets of bogies, you got to put a new set of bogies on. You grease them up every morning and grease them and grease them. They weren't made to travel up Holland like that. No. And then we got orders, we got to go back to the British Second Army. And of course, they had not got enough Class 70 bridges to bridge all the way up Holland where they'd blown them. So they took the 70s up and put 40s in the place so we couldn't get back to the British Second Army. So we had a recce, and they found bridges partly blown, but we could get across, you know. And I mean, that was a dicey business, but they got the whole squadron across, right up the north of Holland.
What did these bridges look like?
Oh, they were on the move like this, because half of them were blown, you know, and you're coming down into the rubble and going out of the rubble. Anyway, we got across back to the British Second Army, and of course we was in Germany again then, and we was just south of Bremen, I think, and I began to think the war was hotting up. Because we went along a road there, and there was jeeps and kangaroos all blown to bits, and the road there was big holes with Bailey bridges across them. I thought, well, what's this? There was about four or five Bailey bridges within a half a mile, and what had happened? We found out afterwards that they'd run across the Jerry Royal Engineer School. And where the academy, like, or where they trained these people, and what they'd done, they'd fitted up a ratchet mine to an aircraft bomb and planted them all in these roads up in the low spots, so that wherever they blew up, you got to bridge it because you couldn't get off the road. And, well, we got over them, and we got to a place called Darmstadt, I think. Darmstadt, that was, somehow or the other, that they'd laid an attack on for our half squadron, and we went up to take up position for the start in the morning.